Flashback Twin Cities, Tom Osmond here on KLDV, Club 1220, where it's apparently 1 degree outside. I can really feel that warmth coming in here at the coldest Valentine's Day in 72 years, which is appropriate for today, unfortunately, for those that are going to be going out and fighting the elements of weather, trying to have that nice dinner tonight, but we will make it through here the next hour. A sad story, a couple sad stories today, but one I want to spend the first part of today's show talking about. David Carr, if you don't know the name, you probably have heard it the last couple days here. David Carr was a columnist, media columnist for the New York Times. And to those of us who've been media junkies our whole lives, you'll remember David Carr from his writing at the Twin Cities Reader and Corporate Report, among other local publications here in the metro area. And David Carr, unfortunately, died untimely at the age of 58 yesterday. And I want to bring on a guest today, someone who we've had on the show before, a good friend of our show, David Brower. David, are you on the line?
I am, Tom. Hi.
Well, David, thank you for being on the show, unfortunately, under the circumstances you're on today. But David Carr, a character in Twin Cities media, and a name that maybe isn't known in the mainstream of some of the bigger names here locally, but nationally, David Carr, obviously his untimely departure has been a big news story, and you knew him. Many of us read David Carr's work before he went to New York, and you knew him when he was writing stories for the Twin Cities Reader.
Right.
Do you remember the first time you met him? Do you remember the first time you... Because a person... I've met David Carr before. Unfortunately, I only met him one time. It's a meeting you don't forget. Do you recall that first meeting with him?
You know, I don't. It's kind of lost to the mists of time. I'm pretty sure that we met when we were 35 years ago, when we were waiting tables together at the Anchorage restaurant that used to be in Northeast Minneapolis. It was up where 35W meets Industrial Boulevard. And it was just, you know, sheer coincidence. We both wanted to be journalists, and he was a couple of years older than me, but it was a high time in more ways than one. And it turned out we both went to the U, and we both interested in journalism, and so we ended up getting together, you know, often at college as well as at work, and all kinds of hijinks ensued.
There's a kind of group of journalists, and I think that, not to be too self-promoting, but I had this video years ago, The Facts, and this was a cable access program that a lot of young journalists appeared as panelists on, a format which is pretty common now on cable news, and I had this tape years ago, and I popped it online, and David, you're part of this, and through demand the last few days, I've gotten a lot of requests for more videos. I posted some more that I had not planned on putting them ever online, at least, well, I had planned on putting them online, never in this kind of fashion, and unfortunately in a tribute fashion to David Carr, but you and David grew up in a time, a lot of young journalists who wanted to really get their teeth into the work. You weren't able, it was a time of changing, papers were merging, stations here in town were coming under corporate ownership. You guys were doing the local readers, the city pages, the Twin Cities Reader. Many people may not recall, but the Twin Cities Reader and the city pages were two competing, they were the Pioneer Press and Star Tribune of their era. And you guys were writing in what we would call the alternative dailies or weeklies.
Right. I mean, it was a good time for alternative weeklies because the dailies, frankly, had left us a lot of room. At the time, newspapers were, you know, making 30% margin. So for every dollar they brought in, they were able to pocket 30, 40, 50 cents in some cases. There was no Craigslist. The classifieds were fat. Journalists who got hired there ended up, you know, retiring there. But they had fallen out of touch, frankly, with the whole sort of aftermath of the counterculture, I guess I would say. Everybody who went from the 60s counterculture and was now, like, getting real jobs and doing real things but still like to go out to the clubs and still like to, you know, do that stuff, they weren't really being served. And so a couple of guys from the Minnesota Daily business side started the Twin Cities Reader in the late 70s. There'd actually been an alt-weekly called Metropolis here before that, but it died pretty quickly. And then around 1980, Tom Bartel started a music publication that was Sweet Potato, and it became city pages when it added news. And so a lot of bar ads, a lot of sex ads, frankly, that couldn't go in the daily paper, a lot of personal ads, which were a big part of the whole deal. Again, you know, sort of before online and all of that. And, you know, in the beginning, the Reader was really smart about its business and really well run. Editorial side never really had a huge budget when David started there. But, you know, when David, who's still a waiter and stumbled across a story of alleged police brutality when he was 23 and I was 21, he showed it to me and I sort of looked it over because he never submitted a story that long or that detailed to anybody. And, he went off and took it to Brian Lambert, who was, then the editor of the Twin Cities Reader. Now he's the media critic at MinnPost. And, you know, you could just walk a good story in off the street and people would buy it. And so you could talk about things like police brutality in a more sort of new journalism way. You could use all the profanity you wanted, although that story was not profanity heavy. You could tell a story in whatever way seemed best, not in sort of according to inverted pyramid, most important stuff at the top. And it was just a free time. It was a time when if you were willing to work for cheap, you could end up getting a job where you could at least support yourself. I think the first job, the first full-time job that I had at the Reader, I want to say I got paid $24,000, and that would have been around 1990. And, you know, that's a lot of money today. People who are breaking into the business today don't make as much. But anyway, David had the same voice that he's always had and he's since become famous for. He was somebody who knew the rough side of the tracks because, you know, even then he was a big drug user and he had to deal with a lot of unsavory people. But at the same time, he was very smart, always incredibly creatively spoken, I guess I would say. He was one of the rare writers I knew that had a gift for natural sounding language in his prose and his words, but also was creative when he was talking. He would, you know, describe somebody who was a, you know, sort of a complicated person or a complicated mess as a bag of snakes. That was right. One of David's. And so anyway, it was a perfect time and a better time in some ways to break into the industry.
I think one thing I appreciate most about David Carr's work, and I think our friend Brian Lambert probably said it best, is he's a person that he asks the questions that I think that you get this a lot, ask the questions that people were afraid to ask. No, he really probed questions, whether it was Chief Tony Boza or it was if there was a highfalutin black tie dinner. He asked the questions that were not comfortable, and he asked them in a way where people would still answer the questions. People would still answer the questions, and he'd be able to get a story for the Reader that would be so entertaining, depending on whether it was at a Democrat fundraiser or it was a police press conference. He could be easily in with the cocktail crowd, and also based on his background, whether it be the back room of Moby's or it be at some of the, as we talked about before, the rougher elements of society. And that, I think, was his real gift, being able to go, and maybe sometimes part of his own demons, being able to go teeter back and forth from both of those places. But you really got some great story in a very honest way of telling it. He did not, you know, you mentioned that it was a time of freedom in journalism, and I've read these stories. It's not a vulgar story, but it's stories in detail that you're not going to get from someone who may be embarrassed or shy to talk about some parts that make us uncomfortable.
Yeah, and David, one of David's talents, I mean, obviously, he had charisma even then. I mean, certainly the most charismatic person I knew. And so, you know, I think it drew people to him that wouldn't otherwise be drawn to, say, a drier, more serious, more upright journalist, even like myself back in those days. I was certainly, you know, looser than the Daily guys, but not as free-swinging as David. He, you know, the other thing about David is that he played the game really well. If you know, he was not above making friendships with the people he covered. I always found that to be a little, for myself, not judging him, but for myself, I always found that a little bit icky. Like, you know, I was sort of raised to be more of a rule follower, and so, you know, I didn't want to write about people that I palled around with or go had drinks with. And, you know, I look back on it and I go, that was a little bit uptight. But David would, David made pals in the system. He made pals with criminal defense lawyers. He made pals with politicians, not all of them, and not willy-nilly, but he was willing to do just about anything to get a good story. And a lot of that was just your basic human relations. I mean, he took the freedom of the alt-weeklies and used it to its fullest.
And David also, I mean, he carried a lot with him. I think that when, and it's what's interesting, I think, and I read a friend Brian Lambert's column, he, you know, where the Star Tribune and the Pioneer Press, when the mainstream media lost here in the Twin Cities, it was others' gain. And he went to New York in the early 2000s after a couple other stints. And his book, and I'm sure you've read his book. I've read his book.
Yes.
It's really a great read, and I hope that it's one that people should have read before his untimely death. But again, it really puts the essence of David Carr, David Carr. And I've actually been watching these videos that have been floating around. It's actually, you can watch David Carr on TV on tcmedianow.com. There's not a lot of video of David Carr around. This is during his, we'll call it his fun period. You could tell that, and also the panelists that are with him, including yourself, and I don't think you mentioned this, but people do poke a bit at his enjoyment of being down on Block E and some of we'll call it his other habits. They justly talk about it, and he's pretty free about it. There's a part of the video where he's smoking a cigarette in the middle of this panel, which you can't even smoke in a bar today, and he's smoking in this panel. I think that it might be Brian Lambert or someone that is trying to wave his hand away from him because the cigarette's about ready to burn his hair. But that's David right there.
Yeah, well, that shows you, again, that clip that's on TC Media. Now, I know there's more clips, but the one that I saw was from January 1984, and David would have been about 26 at that time. I was 24. And, watching it the other day in the shock aftermath of his death, he was the more charismatic than the other three of us put together times 10. Like, he already had a love of the stage and a love of storytelling. And that was the sort of fun play, again, magnetism aspect of him that drew people in. I never expected him to leave town because he was such of this place. Like, I moved up here, that was about 5 years after I moved up to town, but he was raised here. His dad was a haberdasher and knew everybody, and he was just so immersed in Minneapolis, St. Paul, that when he left to go work at Washington City Paper, that would have been about 10 years after that clip, I was stunned. And I probably shouldn't have been in hindsight, because David knew how good he was and wanted to play on a bigger stage. He loved power. He loved palling around with it. He loved being able to poke it in the nose. He loved the people with the same kind of magnetism he had. And he decided to get out of his comfort zone to go sort of pursue the ultimate stage. And when you read his stuff on in the New York Times, there's occasionally a clunker, and I think David even admitted to it in print sometimes, where he took it too easy on a certain famous person for whatever reason. I mean, part of it was, in his later years, I think he was trying to be more fair and less the "I'm going to rip heads off everybody's guy."
Right.
Sometimes that, when he fell short, I think it was because he almost became a little bit too
part of the system.
Odd's not the right word, but he was a little too cozy with some of the people in power. But the ultimate truth of what he did was, when he took aim at people for legitimate reasons, he eviscerated them with entertaining efficiency, is how I would say it. And that's why he was so respected. And he was willing to admit his faults, which I thought was magnificent. That's one of the reasons Night of the Gun was so good. I didn't know what to expect when the book came out, because, especially in his years where he was addicted, David would not admit to flaws very easily. And, you sort of soft pedal them. I mean, we all do that to a certain extent, but David certainly, could be pretty defensive about some of that stuff. But in the book, it really showed a coming to terms with all that. You know, he'd been at the Times for several years. I think he was secure in his talent, and he was at the top of the pile when it came to media reporters and analysts. And I think it allowed him to be much more, really amazingly honest with himself and the public.
Did you, as a friend and colleague, did you worry about David? You knew him in the height of probably of his addiction process. Was it something that you worried about, and were you able to talk to him about that?
I did. We all worried about it. I mean, you got to understand that like David, especially when we were in our 20s and had a taste for chemicals, was sort of, for many of us who were more boring and more conventional, was kind of like the Pied Piper. He would drag people along in his personality tornado. That's how I used to describe it. And you know, I learned pretty early on that I was not going to be able to keep up with David because I just did not have the constitution. But he showed me a lot of things and experiences and people and perspectives that I never knew, and it frankly made me a better person because I had more experience. That said, you know, the arc was going to be this guy was the leader, and he did more than any of us, and he just kept doing it. And at various points with various friends, some of us hung in there, and some of us had to break off because it was just getting too weird. I think David had better friends than me in the sense that they understood his life and maybe shared some of his pathologies more than I did, and they were willing to hang in there with him and push him toward treatment harder than I was able to. I was sort of the little brother in the group, and you know, when David didn't want to do something, there really wasn't going to be any talking him out of it. But there were people that he saw as bigger brothers, including members of his family, that I think were able to get through to him. And the truth is, you know, he went to treatment several times. I remember when he went the first time. I want to say it was I don't know if it was the first time, but the first time I knew about it, I want to say like it was a weekend program, or maybe it was a 28-day program. I don't remember anymore, but it just clearly wasn't enough for a guy who was that addicted, had those kind of addictive genes. So did we talk about things going wrong and things going bad? Absolutely we did. And you know, David was not afraid to have those conversations in certain circumstances. But you know, I guess if anybody's dealt with alcoholism or drug abuse in their family, it's certainly not true of everybody, but there is a certain time where it's gotten so bad and you know, the usual stuff has been tried, that, you know, you kind of have to let them get bottom. And it's not, you know, it sounds awful, but addiction is awful. And really, I think what it took for David was having his twin daughters and wanting to get them away from their mom, who was, you know, a crack dealer. Gotcha. Because he had such a strong sense of family, I think ultimately he saved himself, but his family needs are what drew him out of the worst of times.
And I guess David Brower and David, you're with Southwest Journal. You were with MinnPost last time we were in the show. You were at Southwest Journal. And not to put you in the spot, not to have you reveal things you don't want feel comfortable revealing, but did you know how bad the addiction was when David's book came out? And I remember reading this, and I'd heard stories. You know, these are either tales or things I'd heard from mutual acquaintances. Did you know how bad that, you know, where he had sunk bottom was until you read the book? Were you surprised by that?
No, I wasn't surprised because we talked about what had happened, you know, after he started to be in recovery and before he wrote the book. So, you know, he was willing to talk. It was part of the recovery, making amends and all of that. I didn't know some of the glorious details at the end. Like, I didn't know about him leaving his twin infant daughters out in the car while he was doing a crack deal. Right. That sort of stuff came at the very end where, you know, some of us just had to get away because David was associating with some bad criminals.
Right.
And so, And, you know, like any addict, he had its secrets and, you know, wouldn't always tell us how bad it was because, you know, he didn't want to. But I think everybody who was in that circle who knew anything knew that, you know, I mean, we all knew David had been arrested. We didn't know maybe how many times he'd been arrested, but, you know, sometimes after he got arrested and we were working together at the Reader, he would tell us, you know, I mean, you just have to explain kind of where he was. And so, and you know, I remember meeting the mother of his daughters in the Twin Cities Reader office, you know, sometime in the 80s, and, you know, just thinking, boy, she's bad news. Like, this is a level of serious drug dealer that I haven't really encountered David having that kind of a relationship with.
Right.
And I think that was probably the time when I knew, you know, like, it's going to get worse. But I didn't always know the full measure of it, but I think we knew the general arc of it pretty well.
It makes you sure appreciate when you read his writing and read his point of view and read kind of his angle of his writings, you know, where that passion comes from. And I think that any artist, and I, you know, you learn this is you know, whether doing film or video or writing, that, you know, part of any kind of brilliance comes in art. It comes from some personal angst and some personal challenges. And you know, if life was simple, you wouldn't have any passion to. I don't think you'd have enough passion to draw from to be able to create something. I would encourage anyone listening today to read the personal obituaries that Brian Lambert, for example, and others in the Star Tribune have written. I think are really, you know, really talk about David's essence of personality. The Associated Press one is very basic. It's very almost resume-like. The personal stories that I've been reading the last few days, whether it be tweet, you know, through Twitter or through MinPost or through blogs, those are the stories I encourage people to read. And I'm sure you probably agree with me, David, that the personal stories, the interactions with him, that's really David Carr right there.
Yeah, it's been even breathtaking for me. And I did not know how many people David had touched since he left Minneapolis and how deeply he helped so many people with their careers. I worked for him a couple of times when he was editing the Twin Cities Reader, and well, he's always a great journalist. He wasn't disciplined enough when I was here to be a great manager, and there were some people that got hurt that I still feel bad for, just we all are allowed to grow up, and we all are allowed to change. And, you know, some of the more surprising things for me is I didn't know the full measure of his history at Washington City Paper and how he got a lot of prominent journalists today their start, including a lot of minority journalists. And, you know, clearly the measure of how beloved he was at the New York Times was, you know, when they had a, you know, newsroom memorial to him and pretty much everybody showed up. I mean, that showed to me that, you know, the good David, the David that was truly special, obviously had been allowed to come out and to blossom in all the years after he left Minneapolis as he got further along in his recovery. He had some relapses, by the way, at least involving alcohol, and he was pretty honest about those, but I think he ultimately got those back under control and obviously had a strong support network. So, you know, the love that came out for him was overwhelming within the journalism world, and it was legit. It was, you know, he changed my life, and it sounds like he continued to change people's lives for decades after he left here through all of his struggles, and that is an amazing achievement.
It's just it's a character in Twin Cities media and national media, and it's a person that well, physically not with us, he's going to be around for a long time, and I think this is it's just a great story, and I appreciate. I know that this is you've probably been, your phone's been beeping and buzzing the last couple of days when the news broke on Thursday night, so I appreciate you coming on Flashback Twin Cities today. I just think it's a great story, an important story, and I really love the personal anecdotes, you know, really people that knew him well and were able to share experiences with him. I think, again, you and some of the journalists of the mid-80s when you guys were blossoming, it's just such a great time. It may not happen the same way again with the way the media is now, You guys were doing odd jobs in order to, get some dead tree print out there, and it's just not the same way anymore. But again, David Brower, our guest today at Southwest Journal, appreciate your time today, and next time you're on the show, we'll have hopefully some happier things to talk about.
Well, Tom, you've done just such a great job of unearthing and promoting the history that we now all have, that I'm just super grateful for that, and I'm really grateful that thanks to you, people were able to see David really in his physical prime, because he was so sickly looking at the end of his career. That's just really special, and that's a tribute to you, and I'll do whatever you need. So thank you.
Thank you, sir. And by the way, we'll have a mini marathon on tcmedianow.com this weekend. We have three more of the facts on, and I have a couple more in queue. So keep watching, and watch David Carr at his best, and even see David Brower on a January 84 episode, which I know you appreciate seeing that.
Yeah, it's fun. My fun for my kids to see it. So thank you, Tom. That's awesome.
David Brower, Southwest Journal. We will take a break. We'll come back on Flashback Twin Cities here on KLBB Club 1220.
This is Grant from the Tavern on Grand. They say if you're going to serve walleye to Minnesotans, it's got to be good. That's why the Tavern on Grand is sometimes called Minnesota State Restaurant. We serve Minnesota State fish, the walleye. Tavern on Grand in St. Paul has made an art form out of walleye. Delicious, tender, flaky walleye that's offered in a variety of ways. Any way you order your walleye at the Tavern on Grand, it's guaranteed to be great. See for yourself why folks come back time and time again for the walleye and all the other tasty treats. For the Tavern on Grand, St. Paul at 656 Grand Avenue. Just half a block west of Dale Street.
O'Reilly. Get more mileage from your tax refund at O'Reilly Auto Parts. If you've been delaying those minor repairs, go to O'ReillyAuto.com for a coupon worth $15 off a $75 purchase. Spend part of your tax refund on your vehicle now and avoid costly repairs down the road. O'Reilly Auto Parts. Better parts, better prices every day. Restrictions apply. See offer for details.
O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Another virus?
Relax. At Computer Repair and Services, every repair costs $99.95 and nothing more. Whether we spend 1 hour or 3 days, repairing your PC is always $99.95. I'm Joe Gillette. Visit Computer Repair and Services at 1441 Stillwater Boulevard or call us at 651-439-7544. It's just $99.95 for every PC repair, excluding hardware. At Computer Repair and Services, you can afford to fix your PC.
You ever wonder what it means to follow Jesus? How can we follow someone we can't physically see? This week in particular, I'll be talking about what a life of following Jesus might look like. This is Pastor Mike Carlson of St. Andrew's Lutheran Church in Mount Emidi, and we invite you to listen to our worship broadcast live this Sunday morning at 9 a.m. on AM 1220 KLBB Radio.
Live from St. Andrew's Lutheran Church in Mount Emidi, this Sunday morning at 9 on Club 1220 KLBB.
Flash at Twin Cities, Tom Osmond here. It's the second part of the show. Last week we had Ben Petter Johnson on, and Ben Petter Johnson is a national voiceover actor. And it's a name that you would not know, but you would know the voice. And unfortunately, it's unfortunate we have to continue the line of deaths this week, but Gary Owens, announcer of Laugh-In fame, died at 80. And I want to just read a little bit from Variety. Radio, TV, and voiceover performer Gary Owens died on February 12th at his home in Encino neighborhood of Los Angeles. Owens was 80, had been diabetic since the age of 8. Owens was probably best known as the announcer of NBC's Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In, with his trademark hand-over-the-ear announcing style. On the show, John Wayne once imitated Owens, announcing the phrase Owens created on his KMPC radio show, Beautiful Downtown Burbank, which later became a nightly catchphrase on Johnny Carson's Tonight Show. Owen also lent his voice to more than 3,000 cartoons, providing the voice of Space Ghost, as well as Blue Falcon, Roger Rabbit, Powder Toastman, and even Batman. He was animated as himself in Garfield and Friends, Fantastic Four, Eek the Cat, and Bobby's World. Owen had a mellifluous baritone voice with impeccable enunciated timing and was equally adept at comedy or deadpan delivery. For 30 years, Owens hosted a national radio show on Music of Your Life Network. He was a longtime radio personality at KMPC, KFI, KIS-FM, KF, WWB and KKJO in Los Angeles, and at KEWB in San Francisco. He collaborated with his friend Jonathan Winters together, creating three hit comedy CDs. He wrote for Jay Ward's comedy for the series Rockin' Bullwinkle, Fractured Flickers, and The Nut House. Owen's daily radio show on KMPC in Los Angeles for 20 years, and he later served as VP of Gene Autry's Golden West Broadcasters. In 1983, he became VP of Gannett, then the USA's biggest media corporation. I want to play a few Gary Owens clips here. Again, it's a voice you may not recognize, or sorry, a name you may not recognize, but you'll know the voice. This first one is a Fruity Pebbles commercial with Gary Owens animated as himself with Fred and Barney.
Party rubble for the grand prize. What's the fruitiest cereal in Bedrock?
That's a toughie.
You blockhead! Barney!
You know my Pebbles is the fruitiest.
I could use a reminder. I don't know.
Take them all!
Fruity Pebbles, the winning combination of fruity flavors.
But what about
this? This is my grand prize.
Barney!
Host Fruity Pebbles cereal, part of this complete breakfast.
I'm sure Gary Owens would be proud to know that his work is well known in the Fruity Pebbles commercial, but you have the animated Gary Owens, you have Fred and Barney. I think it's a pretty much an all-star cast right there. There's a couple more here I want to play. I was actually, before the show started today, I was looking up some of these, and they're pretty fun. The voice, again, you recognize the voice, and if you, a lot of our viewers were old enough to remember Laugh-In, he was the announcer, he had his hand, it looks like the 1940s radio announcer. This is one from 1988 for KFI Radio.
Hi, I'm Gary Owens. Now on KFI 640, we put together a fun show for you every morning, including airborne traffic reports from KFI in the Sky, morning news and sports, plus your favorite music. We have... Sorry, a little clumsy on my part, so tune in to KFI 640 every morning for me, Gary Owens. Could someone clean this up?
Gary Owens, now on KFI.
I didn't think that someone was me.
It sounds like a Brown College voice, right, Kyle?
Oh, yeah, a little bit.
Owens started as a radio newscaster in Mitchell, South Dakota. When he arrived in Hollywood in 1961 for KFWB, he also began his TV career doing four television specials a year for Chris Kraft Corp. and later their television station KCOP. Since its inception in 1969, he was the announcer on Sesame Street. He was also one of the original contributors to the PBS series The Electric Company. He is survived by his wife of 57 years, Arletta, and sons Scott Owens, the producer, and Chris Dane Owens, a musician and producer. Donations may be made to the Children's Diabetes Foundation. Gary Owens, again, a name you may not know, but you'll know the voice, and what a voice it is. It's a voice that, when you imitate the old 1940s radio voice, that's the voice you do, and Gary Owens just did it naturally. He actually had a book called How to Make $1 Million with Your Voice, and I'm going to work on this later tonight and get that voice down so I can make $1 million. Let's take a second commercial break. We have a guest which we're trying to get on the line here, and hopefully we'll be able to get him on the line. We'll take a quick break here and come back here in Flashback Twin Cities on KLBB.
As their menu says, life is uncertain. Best to eat dessert first. At Sail Away Cafe, their desserts are so unbelievably delicious, you'll want to start with dessert. Gooey butter cake, chocolate ganache cake, homemade cheesecake, or key lime pie, to name a few favorites. But save room for some delicious homemade soup, homemade pizza, or dinner of pasta Adriatica. You'll be glad you did. Sail Away Cafe is fine dining with a hometown feel. So gather up your friends and meet at the Sail Away Cafe in Afton for dessert, breakfast, lunch, dinner, or live music on the weekends. Destination, Sail Away Cafe. Cafe in Afton.
Find out why more people come here to River Valley Ford.
Your truck headquarters in the St. Croix Valley is River Valley Ford in Baldwin. It's a great time to buy a new F-Series truck, and Ford Motor Company has made the deals too good to ignore. Outstanding factory rebates and incredible lease options mean you could be driving a new Ford truck today. Our inventory of new trucks has never been better, so stop and see us today. Shop, compare, and find out why so many of your friends and neighbors choose River Valley Ford in Baldwin.
Club 1220 KLBB presents the Community Calendar. The American Red Cross is holding a blood drive today at Presbyterian Church of the Way in Shoreview. Special Olympics Minnesota is having a polar plunge today at Carver Lake Beach in Woodbury. Join the St. Croix Valley Lumberjack Special Olympians after the plunge this afternoon at Buffalo Wild Wings in Stillwater. The Warner Nature Center and Marina on St. Croix is holding a winter blizzard blast this afternoon until 5 with a snowshoe hike and winter games. Willow River State Park near Hudson is having its annual candlelight ski night tonight starting at 6:30. There's also candlelight skiing tonight at the Washington County Park in Lake Elmo and at Interstate Park in St. Croix Falls. The play Aladdin Jr. being presented this afternoon at 4 by the Phipps Children's Theater in Hudson. There will also be a show on Sunday afternoon. Visit thephipps.org for tickets.
Wafa Twin Cities, Tom Osen here on KLDB. Our second guest is, we're working on that, but in the meantime, I have a couple more pieces of information on David Carr. I just want to read a couple different segments here from MinPost, which I recommend, if anyone's interested in David Carr, if you've never read David Carr's work, I recommend reading it because it is, it's a voice that is just not commonly heard, and you have reporters that can report and writers that can write, and he can do both. Brian Lambert wrote this piece in MinPost. This would have been yesterday. And this is from the voice of Brian Lambert. Over the years, Carr, as most people around the Twin Cities called him, was far too kind in mentioning me as the guy who gave him his first break. And Brian Lambert hired him at the Twin Cities Reader. The big, blubber, disheveled guy with a classic Irish wit who wandered into my office way back when was one of the biggest breaks I ever got. Here's a character with an enormous appetite for a lot of exhilarations of life, including telling a darn good story. There was nothing gray or homogeneous about Carr. I may have kissed him after he delivered his second or third piece for me. As 2 turned to 3 this morning, I kept rolling back and forth the yin and yang of Carr's existence. Again, this is the voice of Brian Lambert writing in MinPost. A couple of years ago in New York, we fell into a conversation about the essentials of a good reporter. I could never pretend to be one. Carr was by then in the pantheon of greats, a fundamental facet of being a great reporter, as he saw it, and one which I completely agree, is the ability to play a high-low game. Plenty of dutiful, earnest news people can interact with the officialdom of the high game, nibbling at and partying with the rule-bound bureaucracies of politics and businesses, but also the same people who often struggle attempting to draw life and meaning from the low game, the unsophisticated, the meek, the duller and witted, and the criminal. To be able to speak in both voices and, more importantly, ask persistent questions of each is a special talent, and in Carr's case, one that required living each firsthand. Carr's remarkable life arc depended on him never forgetting he was from a barely middle-class Hopkins family raised by a ragman father. He worked in a men's clothing store and his career Irish mom. Nor did he ever forget the abyss in which he fell. We talked about that hole, his often recalled collapse into crack addiction, simultaneous with a Hodgkin's lymphoma diagnosis for his book, Night of the Gun. I knew with him, if not best in those days, in no small part because of the fact that before he completely cratered, running with Carr, as I told a reporter last night, just ridiculously great fun. Whether it was in the back room at Moby Dick's, where he seemed to be on a first-name basis with a collection of characters who had never heard of Hopkins, much less the world's shortest St. Patrick's Day parade, or teetering off the roof of the old Produce Bank building, a night with Carr inevitably meant tasting the exhilaration of scuffing up against morality. When the book, which is a terrific read, was published, I complimented him for being brave enough to factor in the fun factor of his slide to near obliviation. Junkie memoirs are rarely honest until they give full perspective on the why. Because of how we met, I had a different relationship with Carr than a lot of his local journalism peers. As he clawed himself back out of the abyss and in a true secular miracle restored his credibility, he became the employer and mentor and, according to muttered legends, was not always easy to deal with. Probably because he respected effort as much as talent, and when he didn't see the former, he was much less impressed with the latter. I didn't see Carr much in recent years. We had dinner with our wives in New York a couple years ago, a night memorable as much for his extraordinary, almost over-the-top politeness to the waitress as his conversation we had. He never forgot his years wearing the scales, a goofy theme apron that was required for his one-time job at a local seafood joint. I want to just go off script here and play a little bit from this video we've been talking about a little bit today. This is David Carr on The Facts in January of 1984. It's a cable access show that you would think today the esteemed journalist would not appear on cable access. This is, we'll call some young reporters that were working a combination of radio and TV and newspaper. These weren't on-air TV guys. These were people that were in the on the crew or working for the reader, and I want to play a little audio right here. This is David Carr in January 84.
On this thing, you know, from step one, and there was very little in the way of excitement. And as soon as people saw a crack, boy, they were just going to leverage the heck out of it and get as much as they could. Now everybody's fired up about it. I think one point we need to mention about press coverage is that Native son Walter Mondale has been resurrected on the pages of the Minneapolis Star and Tribune again and again. Today,
Finley Lewis had a story. I hope you saw
yes,
it.
Yes, today the headline.
I think the word used was electrifying. An electrifying speech.
Yeah,
let me talk about my former employer here just a minute. Are you talking about the headline that said Mondale even with Reagan and Pohl?
Yeah.
And then you look a little closer and it's Minnesota Pohl?
Yeah, Minnesota Pohl. But even under that, there was this Finley Lewis story. Mondale's official sanctioned biographer. And I'd never met Mr. Lewis.
And there you go. And it's when you listen to a radio, it seems like a pretty dull piece, but it's actually a lot of fun to watch. And if you are interested in journalism or interested in a bunch of guys who know facts, watch this program. I'm going to be doing a kind of mini marathon on PCMedianow.com this weekend, putting up some more David Carr video. Being we have some time, we're not going to have a second guest, but we have some time, and I am going to play a little catch-up because we have some video pieces which I wanted to play the last couple of weeks, and I haven't had an opportunity to. So I want to play a video clip, and this a little bit fitting. We are about, we're already 2 weeks away from Super Bowl, or we're 2 weeks past it. This video piece aired on HBO when Minnesota was the host of Super Bowl in 1992. And in true fashion, it was a miserably cold Minnesota time. And we're going to get the Super Bowl again, I think, in 2018.
Yeah, 18,
the year that we have our brand-new billion-dollar stadium opened up. But it was to have a Super Bowl in a cold climate is a pretty rare event. And to have it in another dome, which I think many still thought was a very unappealing stadium. But Governor Perpich, a few years back, had done what he needed to do to get the Super Bowl here. So this piece aired on HBO, and I wanted to air it before the Super Bowl, but we just didn't have time because we had a full show. This is what the HBO national audience was thinking about what Minnesota was going to be for a Super Bowl. So we'll play that here.
Current temperatures, huh?
12 degrees with a wind chill of 5.
And if you've been out to the airport, or if you haven't, make sure you go out there. A lot of decorations and things up. And they've left my sign up. Have you seen that?
No, I have not.
I put a big sign up as you go down into the baggage area. It says, "Welcome to Minnesota. Don't lick anything."
KKWB. Super Bowl 26 visitors will find that most people here in Minnesota don't fight winter. They embrace it. Like here at Forest Lake. Site of the $115,000 Golden Rainbow Ice Fishing Contest. I think I see one. Among the contest rules, dead or frozen fish are ineligible, and prize winners must agree to a polygraph exam.
3 ounces.
A quiet pursuit? Some of these ice anglers know otherwise.
A truck fell in the lake. Well, didn't fall all the way in, but fell in, you know.
The Super Bowl's favorite weather color is usually sunny yellow. But this year, the NFL agreed to bring back the Ice Age. Here, they lend a new meaning to the term icebox. But ice carvers tend to be choosy about their blocks. They also have to be cautious, because believe it or not, sometimes it's too cold to dice the ice.
Well, as it gets colder below zero, the ice gets real brittle, and, you know, the ice will tend to explode as you use a power saw, as you can hear in the background.
In Minnesota, they've got all the normal activities on ice and quite a few more. Who said baseball was only for the boys of summer? And ice water skiing is great if you don't fall. There's ice car racing and something that looks like ice soccer. There's ice jogging, of course, and, well, ice cream. In the land of 10,000 lakes, all frozen in winter, they've got enough ice to build a castle. So they did. Thousands of blocks later, St. Paul has the most expensive and tallest ice structure in the world. Although there is something fishy going on here.
One of the ice cutters from We Cut Ice Company just happened to saw right into this particular block. It was a miracle. We're all absolutely astonished.
When the sponsor writes a $500,000 check, miracles on ice can happen.
Twin Cities Best Mix is 101.3 KDWB. Stand by. Mr. Science has an experiment going on this morning. They say it's hot enough to fry an egg on the sidewalk in the summertime. Well, is it cold enough to freeze an egg?
Later, live by cellular phone, our inquiring DJ surveyed his experiment.
Yes, you can fry an egg on the sidewalk in the summertime, but you can't please freeze an egg on the sidewalk in Minneapolis in the winter.
No runny gookie parts?
No, it's solid as a rock.
Is it really?
Hello?
Yes, the cold and gray can make you crazy. That's why the Finger Hut Company here recently put its employees on a flight to find the sun. Of course, in this state, a weatherman's wisdom is precious.
Quite often, when I talk about the weather in the Twin Cities, I will use a verse. And there's one that goes like this. When the clouds are wild and the hoarse winds blow, and the lanes and hollows with drifts are piled, I think of violets under the snow.
I purchased every tube of chapstick in town. And I'm selling them at $100 a piece.
I love that when they look at our little town here, our little state here, and think that we're living in igloos, which, when you think about it, we're building these ice castles. There was an ice palace that year on Heard Island. I'm just looking at some ice palace stats here, because someone asked me when the last time we had an ice palace. That would have been 2004. And I remember being about as cold as it was today, the coldest Valentine's Day in 72 years. And that was at Heard Island. It was designed by Rust Architects. It was 166 feet high, 20,000 blocks of ice measuring 42 by 22 by 20 inches from Green Lake near Spicer, Minnesota. That's where the ice came from. You know, I am guessing that the 2018 Super Bowl will probably have an ice palace. I can't see why they would not want one. I'm looking at some more ice palace stats here. The tallest ice palace part of that had been, and again, only in Minnesota. We've had many people that have on this show who came here from the south, and I asked them, why did you come here? I assume you were interviewed during the summer, and you saw the greenery that we love, which somehow we have to pay for during the months of October through May. But the Ice Palace in 1986, which was by Phelan Park Picnic Island, it was $200,000 of donated labor, 128 feet, 9 inches by length, 90 feet, width 90 feet. The 1986 Ice Palace was built for the 100th anniversary of the Winter Carnival. It was the tallest of the ice palaces built this time. It was the first palace illuminated by computerized lighting. And we have no ice palace, but if you want to see some ice palace, go to tcmedianow.com. We have a couple of good documentaries on the building of the 86 and 1992 ice palace. I'm guessing when this palace, if we do a palace in 2018, there'll be a lighting ceremony, and we'll all go. I remember the 2004 ice palace. Have you been to an ice palace, Kyle? Been to one yet?
I have not, and I can't believe that it's been that long since we've had one.
Yeah, it's been a long time. I remember when the 86 one in Lake Phelan was, that was not too far from where I was from, and it was so crazy that you couldn't go near Lake Phelan. You basically were in your car, and again, this was in the 80s when the cars weren't warm, so it's really cold, and even though you had your heat all the way up, your little silver dial, yeah, it just means that you could only see your breath, you know, partially, not the full effect. And basically, you drove around it and you couldn't get near it. But there were some great pictures that are floating around of the Ice Palace. I mean, they had calendars, they had posters, and then 1992, the Heard Island. This was done because of the Super Bowl. It was larger, bigger, and you could actually go up to it. You couldn't go near the Ice Palace in 86. I think there was a couple of melting periods. The one in 2004, I remember going to it, okay? And I remember thinking, oh, you just go downtown St. Paul, you park, and you walk over the Ice Palace, okay? All assumptions you should never make. I remember trying to go to Casetas, and that didn't go well because the line out the door was about a mile long. I remember going over to the Ice Palace, and again, this is we're talking 20 below. And I think I was a bit smarter than the weather, so I, of course, didn't wear enough warm clothes because I thought that I was, you know, going to be, you know how that
right,
goes.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. You you're the tough guy.
I wouldn't want my hair to get messed up, probably. I was probably kind of impressed. So you walk through it, and then you think to yourself, okay, I'm walking through an ice structure. I'm freezing myself right now walking down the street, and I'm going to go to an ice structure. But somehow in Minnesota we do it. The news desks, when the news anchors go out and they do this on the spot, Ice Palace coverage, they have an ice desk. And that, again, only in Minnesota would we do that. We build ice structures because we just don't think it's cold enough. We need to really embrace that ice culture. But again, ice palaces, Super Bowls. We'll have a Super Bowl in 2018. I'm really glad that they chose Bud Kraling to be the weatherman they spoke to about Minnesota weather, because no one knew about Minnesota weather more than Bud. He'd done it for about 40 years at that point. I think, Kyle, we're gonna let it go. I think we didn't have a guest today, so we're gonna wrap up a little early. We'll do some music here on KLBB. Again, this is Flashback Twin Cities. We'll come back next week with another show. This is Tom Osmond, and we will see you soon.